Peter Forrest is a professor of philosophy at the University of New England in Australia. He's the author of Quantum Metaphysics and God Without the Supernatural.
Okay, Peter, so I exist, you exist, and the universe exists. Why does anything exist at all? And more importantly, is this even a legitimate question to ask in the first place?
The quest for understanding. Clearly, when you explain things, you say one thing in order to understand another thing. And so you're not going to explain why everything exists, because any explanation is in terms of something else that has to exist. But as regards understanding, I think it's a perfectly good question. I don't hold out much hope, in this life at least, for understanding why there's anything rather than nothing. Aquinas might be right. I mean, Aquinas thought that in an afterlife we might be able to see that God just has to exist. But I don't think there's anything like that in this life. And although I think it's a perfectly good question, I doubt whether we're going to have an answer. Okay. But there's a related question. And the related question, which does concern metaphysicians a lot, is why does anything exist that might not have existed? Why does anything exist that comes into existence? And that's a fairly sort of standard issue in which you try to find some necessary thing, maybe the laws of nature or maybe God or whatever, that space and time itself, something that has always been there and just has to exist. So I think that second question is more likely to be answered than the first. But it's a perfectly good question.
Okay. Okay, now, because there's been certain disputes in philosophy in terms of this question. Some people, as yourself, argue that it is a legitimate question. Others argue that it makes grammatical and lexical sense, but really that it doesn't postulate any categories for a potential answer. But at this moment, you believe it is a viable question, at least for getting at some form of understanding in a reductive sense of ongoing explanations. Now, how does necessity and possibility play into this?
Well, I think there's a bit of confusion here, because one sort of necessity is where we cannot even make sense of, we cannot conceive of an alternative. And you might say the necessity of 2 + 2 = 4 is like that. We just can't get our minds around an alternative. Now, anything that's necessary in that sense, we can understand why it exists, but I can't. I don't know of anything that's necessary in the sense that we can't conceive of it not existing. That was the sort of point Hume made. Mm. Now, of course, there are many other senses of necessity, and there are senses in which we might well say, if you're a naturalist, you might well say the laws of nature are necessary. If you're a theist, like myself, you might say, no, God made the laws of nature, but God is necessary. But those sorts of necessities aren't the sort where you can't conceive of it, you can't think of it not being the case. I mean, if you couldn't think of God not being the case, the atheist would just be confused. And I don't believe atheists are confused, I just believe they're wrong. Likewise, if the laws of nature, if you couldn't think of them being otherwise, then people who held the laws of nature were different, people like, say, Newton, from the way they actually are, would somehow be confused, and I don't believe that's so. So there's this other sense of necessity, which is very important, things that are metaphysically necessary, as we say, and as I said, the naturalist will say the laws of nature are metaphysically necessary. The theist can say that God is metaphysically necessary, but simply saying something is metaphysically necessary doesn't enable us to understand it. To understand it, you'd have to somehow see that it was metaphysically necessary.
Okay, so you're saying even if it's metaphysically necessary, that still doesn't help us understand it. So whether it's just the laws of nature that are necessary, or whether it's a theistic explanation that are necessary, it couldn't be any other way, but it still doesn't help us understand the nature of existence.
Not unless we can see that it couldn't be any other way. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Now, what in terms of, obviously this plays into contingency and possibility. What about the simple notion, to a certain extent, if you believe that there's a theistic explanation for the universe that can either be necessary or not, i.e. God had to exist, therefore this is why we have a universe that exists, or God did not necessarily have to exist, but he made a choice in terms of creating other forms of existence, which are ourselves. In terms of possibility, how far can we get in terms of just saying that because this was possible, it meant it could have happened, and it just has happened?
Well, there's so much that could have happened that simply saying it could have happened and it just has happened doesn't seem to me to explain anything. I said that there's a related question, the question of why there's anything that just comes into existence. And there you've got the prospect of explaining the things that just come into existence, that don't exist at all times, in terms of something that has always existed and indeed has to exist. And there I think you've got a genuine answer to the question of why there are contingent things that just happen to exist but might not have existed. That's a more pressing question. It's not as deep a question, but it's a more pressing question than the one you started with. Why there's anything rather than nothing? Why is there anything that just is contingent? Well, you can explain that in terms of some necessary being, I believe. And I think if you have suitable forms of, they could explain why there is space and time, etc., in the first place. Likewise, if you believe in God as a necessary being, as I do, that can explain why there is the things that have to exist. So that more limited question, I think, does involve necessity. Simply saying these things are possible, so they might have existed, doesn't strike me as much of an explanation at all. But there is one in the vicinity.
Okay. Continue.
Yeah, there's one in the vicinity, and it's this. You might say that possible worlds have to exist. Now, that's a contentious issue in metaphysics. But you might, I mean, David Lewis was a very famous proponent of this view, but you might say one way or another that not merely the actual things have exist and they don't have to exist, or at least they don't have to be actual, but that all these possible things exist. Now, if you believe that, and it is a rather startling claim, then you can go on to say, well, the possibilities themselves are necessary. I mean, they're not necessarily actual, but they're necessarily possible. Mm-hmm. That's generally agreed, that if something's possible, it's necessarily possible. So if you can somehow explain things in terms of all this vast array, this plenitude of possibilities, then indeed you have something that's necessary and the array of possibilities. So that's the explanation that I said was in the vicinity of saying, well, it's possible. Merely saying it's possible doesn't seem to explain anything. But if, with a bit of metaphysical sleight of hand or ingenuity, you can somehow explain why there are the things that are actual in terms of all the things that are possible, then you have answered the question. And I mentioned David Lewis, and I disagree with him on some rather important details, but given his view of the matter, he can answer the question, because he can say necessarily there are all these possible worlds, and how do we explain why ours world is actual? Because according to David Lewis, The actual world is just the possible world you happen to be in. Now, that's an explanation. I don't accept it, but that's an explanation of why there is anything actual, given as your starting point that there are all these possible worlds, because then the possible worlds are necessary. There can't be any more or less possibilities, on David Lewis's view anyway. And if you just ask, why is there anything actual? Well, it's just the world we happen to be in. Now, I think that has some alarming consequences and is highly counterintuitive, but it would be an answer to the question. And the fact that there are answers to the question, even if I disagree with them, is one of the reasons I think it was a sensible question in the first place. You know, if you've got a sensible answer, it must be a sensible question.
Sure, sure. So even if we're taking necessity and possibility, and we've got a set of actual possibilities that may have occurred, we still may run into the issue that all those actual possibilities may actually turn out to be necessary possibilities. So, for example, if you've got multiverses and we happen to live in one of the multiverses where the laws of nature were possible to be this way, then that's just one in a whole multitude of variations in laws of nature. Yet for this universe that we occupy to be possible, then that has to be a possibility in the first place, which then brings you back to the issue of whether you need necessary possibilities.
Well, if you grant there are things that are merely possible, if you grant this, then I don't think it's that controversial to say that considered as possibilities, they are necessary. Of course, what's not necessary is which one is actual. And that's where David Lewis had a clever answer, but one that I don't think can be correct, that the actual is just whichever one we're in. So according to David Lewis, there's a possible world in which there are small g gods, you know, Athene and Zeus and Aphrodite and so on. These are all possible worlds, according to David Lewis. And if you were in one of those possible worlds, that world would be actual for you, so there actually would be these small g gods like Zeus and Aphrodite and Athene and so on. Now, I think most of us find that an incredible view. Moreover, some people, including myself, have produced arguments against it. But that's an example where you can see how, if you granted there were all these possible worlds, then they're not necessarily actual, but they're necessarily possible. They have to exist as possible worlds.
Yeah, they have to exist in the first place in some form.
Possible world.
Yeah, sure. Sure, sure. Can I just get your take, not to put you on the spot so much here, Peter, but what do you think in your opinion? Obviously, you disagree with aspects of David Lewis's proposal and you find some of them counterintuitive. From your expertise, what do you feel is the best way to approach answering this question, and something that makes more logical sense for you in terms of why there's any form of existence at all?
Well, it's difficult, but my speculation, and look, I want to emphasize that metaphysics is speculative. We just come up with hypotheses. It's not really like science. But my speculation, for what it's worth, is that the difference between the possible and the merely actual is that there is consciousness in the actual worlds, not in the merely possible worlds. So there might be many actual worlds in which there are conscious beings. So what I think is the case is that they're all physical possibilities, but that only some of these worlds have conscious beings. Now, that doesn't go as far as David Lewis towards explaining why there is consciousness. That is taken as a mystery, just something we have to accept, that there is consciousness. But as regards the explanation of the physical world, I'm inclined to go along with David Lewis and say that, well, there are all these possible physical universes, and what marks the actual is that, as it were, consciousness has focused its attention on just those worlds, and those become the actual ones. The reason why I like that speculation, I don't say I believe it because it's just a speculation, but the reason I like it is that the problems with David Lewis's account all concern conscious beings. There's nothing really very odd in my mind about all these other worlds in which things are physically different. The oddities begin when you think that you and I have counterparts in these worlds, and that whatever we do, the counterparts can do slightly different things. So let's suppose I resist some temptation, and I'm feeling pretty good about it. I've resisted the temptation. Well, one of my counterparts didn't. And that's beginning to get at what I find so counterintuitive about David Lewis's view, that we have, that these other worlds, all of them, even totally bizarre ones, and I believe the bizarre ones outnumber the ordinary ones, are all inhabited, or can all be inhabited, by conscious beings, whereas I see that consciousness would be limited to just certain worlds, and these would count as the actual ones. So unlike David Lewis, I have to take consciousness as a mystery. It's just something I find in the world, consciousness, my own ability to act, to do things. I don't understand these things, but I attempt to understand other things, just taking those for granted.
Okay, so are you saying that one of the markers that demarcates the actual world is the presence of consciousness?
That's my speculation, yes. It's a modification of David Lewis's view.
Okay, so from my perspective, a point of that, but obviously this world is marked out by being occupied by conscious beings that are primarily able to reflect on their own existence, as we're doing right now. But if there are actual worlds where there is no consciousness in those worlds, obviously it can't be self-reflecting. But this doesn't mean that those worlds don't actually exist in themselves. For example, if you take the widely held assumption that consciousness emerged in this universe after the evolution of certain animals, before any life was created on this planet, the universe still existed in some actual form.
Yes, and if the universe, you know, completely originated with the Big Bang, and that's speculation, but if it did, then presumably there was a first occasion in which there were conscious beings in this universe. Of course, I'm not assuming that Earth is the only place in which conscious beings arose, but yes, there was a physical world before there were conscious beings, but I'm claiming the mark of actuality is that in the actual world, there's a conscious beings, actual worlds. In some other worlds, our counterparts are what philosophers jokingly refer to as zombies, beings that are molecule for molecule replicas of conscious beings, but lack consciousness. I know that's a rather odd idea, but those would be the merely possible worlds.
Okay, but I understand that, but they would be the mere possible worlds, but the fact that they exist in themselves, doesn't that also make them actual worlds?
If you like. I mean, this topic is, discussion of possibility and actuality can get confusing like this, because every possibility is actually possible.
So, yes, I appreciate it.
Yes, but they're genuine worlds. They're real worlds. They're real physical worlds. So whereas David Lewis thinks that there's a larger range of possible worlds, I'm simply suggesting, as many materialists would, I'm not a materialist, but as many materialists would, that the range of possible worlds is a range of physical worlds. David Lewis actually allowed ones that were not physical, but I mean, that doesn't really matter. What I'm suggesting is that the range of possibilities is purely physical differences, and that whether a world is conscious or not is nothing to do, is to do with whether it's actual.
Okay, that's interesting. That's interesting. From my perspective, when I think of what actually exists in a realm of possibilities, this might be a kind of a crude, broken down analysis of it. But take the laws of nature, or any laws of nature, gravity, for example. There is no, that we can see at this moment in time, there is no necessary argument for why it is that gravity has to operate the way it does. But obviously, by a logical definition, because it could have possibly operated in other ways, the end product that we see at the moment is just one of those possibilities. So the reason it exists is because there was a potential possibility for it to exist in the first place, and that's why it exists. Now, as you're saying, obviously this leads into further problems in terms of whether the actual is the actual and the possibilities are possibilities in themselves, or whether they're necessary possibilities, which is obviously a problematic issue that we're not obviously going to be able to resolve it quickly in this podcast. But if I could get your thoughts on why you believe a theistic explanation, nonetheless, whether it's necessary or not, because we can all conceive of some form of existence without God, as you were saying. But why is it that you think a theistic explanation is more plausible than an explanation without theism for why there's anything at all?
Well, I think it comes down to a choice between taking the laws of nature for granted, or taking some kind of more or less anthropomorphic idea of an agent, someone who acts, for granted. The Peter van Inwagen expresses this as saying it's a contrast between nomos, for law, and logos. But why do I prefer the view that the ultimate explanation of things is in terms of agency? Well, my line is this, I've already indicated, I'm convinced that of the importance of consciousness and agency. I don't think that sentient beings are just some sort of peripheral byproduct. I think that consciousness and agency are extremely important aspects of the world. I have to take them for granted. I don't understand them. So I think it's sound metaphysical policy to take what you have to accept as a mystery and see what else you can explain in terms of it. I don't have to accept the laws of nature as mysterious things I just take for granted. So I prefer explanations ultimately in terms of agency to those in terms of laws. Now, how that fits with the speculation I've just given in terms of all these possibilities is another and an even more speculative matter. What is agency? I say I have to take it for granted. It's a mystery. But one has to think what goes on when someone makes a choice. And it seems to me that basically they choose between given possibilities. So the question of which possibilities are to be actual, however we characterize actuality, is something which you can either answer in terms of laws. You can say, well, we have these laws rather than those laws, or you can answer in terms of an agent who chooses wisely and well. Incidentally, I don't believe the agent initially chooses lovingly, but wisely and well, as to what will be actual. And the reason I prefer this kind of ultimate agency explanation is that I think I have to take agency for granted as a mystery. I don't think there's any naturalistic account of consciousness and agency that's at all satisfactory, and I don't believe there ever will be one.
Okay, so it's just in terms of the choice there of agency. So an agency chooses to bring certain aspects into existence. Now, of those choices, we're back to the actual possibility riddle again, because of those choices, are you saying that the agent that chooses to bring certain things in existence, that this choice was just a possibility, so it chose it, but the outcome of this choice was never necessary?
I don't think the outcome of choices is necessary, but in some cases, I think, and this distinction goes back to Leibniz, but in some cases, I think it is intelligible. Mm. We can understand it. And the sort of example I give is where the choice is a complete no-brainer and where you're saying. So, I mean, look, you choose where to live, and let's suppose, let's take a sort of fairly arbitrary example, but let's suppose you've got a choice between living in Shanghai and living in Hong Kong, and you draw up a list of sort of pros and cons, and you find all the pros are in favor of living in Shanghai, say. Mm. Then if you're a rational person, you'll live in Shanghai. Now, it's not often choices aren't like that, but I'm just talking about the case where in sometimes when we make a choice, it would be irrational to act otherwise. And then provided we're sane, you know, provided there's not something seriously wrong with us, we choose accordingly. Now, following Leibniz, I think that that's a case where it's not necessary, but it is intelligible. We understand it perfectly well, how you choose in those cases, even though you could have chosen otherwise. Now, to the extent that the divine choice was like that, a case of God making the best possible choice, choosing to perform the best possible act of creation, if it was like that, then it would be entirely intelligible, but it would still not be necessary, which, as I said, I think is Leibniz's position.
Sure, sure. So in this respect, it kind of goes back to what you were saying at the top of the interview, which is it doesn't necessarily at all make it necessary, but it makes us more able to at least make it understandable and intelligible, this act of choosing something.
Yes, if it's that sort of choice. Now, of course, if you have a choice where you have really good reasons for acting one way and really good reasons for acting the other way, that is a little trickier to understand, because in a sense, whatever you do, you had good reasons, so it's intelligible, but then you also had good reasons to act the other way, and that happens, and for all I know, the divine choice might have been like that. But in that case, it's not really intelligible. I mean, it's sort of half intelligible, because you know there are good reasons for acting one way, but because there were good reasons for acting the other, it's not fully intelligible.
Okay.
It's not as random. Random is where you just lack good reasons for acting either way. This kind of difficult choice, dilemma is the word, this kind of dilemma is where you have really good reasons for acting both ways. It's not really random, which is where you lack reasons for acting either way, but it's similar in that you don't have a full understanding of it. So you only get full intelligibility here if God chooses the best possible act of creation.
Okay, but this, again, the best possible act of creation, this isn't a necessary outcome.
No, it's not, I believe, necessary, because God would have the power to choose otherwise. It's just would be totally incomprehensible for God not to choose the best possible act of creation if there is a best possible act to choose, which, of course, is contested.
Okay, so it's one possibility that's not necessarily possible, but it's the best outcome that God could have chose, because he could have acted another way. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say yes, Tony.
Okay, great. So now, if you could just clear up this for me, because this sounds to a certain extent to me that you're just pushing back some kind of fundamental laws just one step further. So if we have something that either could have necessarily existed or didn't have to necessarily exist, and one of the criteria for demarking a form of existence is because an agency has made a choice at some point, then doesn't this agency as well, by the very fact that it A, exists and can make a choice, doesn't this then get subsumed under a natural law? That is, that there are natural laws that facilitate an agent to first exist and therefore make a choice. So an agent acting to choose to bring something in existence, doesn't this make an agent a product of a law of itself? Because how else could the agent exist without this law?
Well, you could say the same, of course, about laws. I mean, do laws need laws in order to exist? But I don't think in either case you do. I mean, I think it's a matter of saying, here's the limits of my explanation. I'm not saying that there's some other law that makes it the case that God exists, or some law that governs God's power to create. God makes the laws. Likewise, the naturalist will not say, okay, well, they're these laws of nature we've discovered, but hey, why have we got these laws rather than some others? There must be some further law telling us that. I mean, either way, you just have to stop somewhere. And I'm not suggesting that it is intelligible, understandable to us that there is this agent God. I'm not suggesting that it's intelligible to us that there are these laws. What I'm saying is that we've got to compare which explanation we prefer. And my reason for preferring theism over naturalism is that I think that in any case, regardless of this issue, we have to accept that there is this mysterious capacity that we all have to be agents, and our mysterious consciousness. I'm saying, here's some mysteries. I've got to accept those. That's a shame. I'd like to understand them, but I can't. So now let's see what else I can explain in terms of them. So I'm not suggesting we can explain everything this way. I'm simply doing a kind of accounting job. Okay, I bought these mysteries anyway. They were very expensive. But now let's see what I can do with them, rather than having to buy something else that's also expensive, unexplained laws.
Oh, okay. That's fair enough. It's just, so essentially, where for you there's a choice here between naturalism and theism, and then you're siding with theism and the very essential aspect that there is first an agency that exists and then can make choices, and then from that we have a universe that materially exists, although there's no way of proving that's all that exists. But nonetheless, we have an agent that makes a choice, and then we have a material universe. Are you therefore saying that agency and consciousness is something that precludes naturalism? So consciousness and agency comes prior to naturalistic materialism?
Yes, prior to any detailed physical structure. I mean, the two may go together in the sense that God may be embodied in the whole universe, etc. But essentially, I agree, yes, it's prior to that, yes.
Okay.
That so it's not explained in terms of the detailed physical structure of things.
Okay, so it would be an opposite argument to materialistic reductionism in neuroscience, in which obviously the hard problem of consciousness has become well proclaimed. So it's the opposite of saying that material properties give rise to consciousness. You're saying it's the other way around.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yes. And putting it that way, we could possibly give an idealist account. The problem with idealism, as usually stated, is that the problem with idealism, as usually stated, is it doesn't seem compatible with the scientific account. But if you're prepared to give an idealistic account of all the quarks and so on, then it becomes quite attractive. I mean, the arguments traditionally produced for idealism seem to me incorrect. But nonetheless, if you do think that agency and consciousness are the sort of ultimate facts of the universe, you might well give an idealist account of the physical world, one which would be compatible with physics.
Okay. So essentially, you're saying we may have to revise the logical structure of how we see things in this respect.
Well, add to it, because to describe something as physical doesn't really tell us anything about it at all. It merely says it's part of a network of connections, causal and other sort of connections. It doesn't tell you anything about its inner nature. You don't even have to posit one if you believe something's physical. To be an idealist, you add to that and say all these physical things, whatever they are, let's suppose they're quarks and electrons, are in fact ideas in the mind of God or whatever. That becomes quite an attractive view, but it's a sort of optional view. It's an add-on. As I said, I find most of metaphysics to be highly speculative.
Okay. So it's not necessarily reversing how we see certain bits, but adding them in different elements. Just one quick thing before I let you go, Peter, because I just want to know what you think the future trend will be in this area philosophically, because there's obviously different strands to this whole issue of the order that materialism and consciousness exists and comes into being. So someone like yourself and someone like Gallum Strawson in the UK philosopher, who I'm sure you're aware of, would posit that consciousness comes prior to any material property. And then on the other side of the argument, you've got extreme materialists, which is someone like Daniel Dennett or to a certain extent A.C. Graylin. What do you think the future trend will be in this philosophically, because the majority of philosophers and neuroscience in this area would say that materialism gives rise to consciousness, and this is obviously a further predicament in itself. But there are people like yourself and Gail Strawson and other theologians that aren't directly working in metaphysics, but at least do philosophy of religion, that do propose opposing views. So I just wanted to see what you thought the future development would be in this area, because rightly or wrongly, some of the aspects that you're putting forward is in the minority, and I just want you to get your thoughts on what you think the future will bring in this area, and whether it can change to become at least halfway or sometime possibly become the majority.
Well, I don't know what will happen, and I'm a bit pessimistic about the prospects for academic philosophy, at least in Australia. I think the glory days are over. But I don't know what will happen. What I hope to happen is that philosophers free themselves from fashion. Mm-hmm. I don't expect there to be agreement, but I'm always unhappy when there's a sort of a trend, a fashion. Mm. What I would like is to see all the tenable views put forward with as much clarity and as much care and concern for argument as is possible. If you I just don't know what will happen. As a matter of fact, the sort of metaphysics I do seems to be flourishing in the United States. As a matter of fact, as you would know, there are far more philosophers in the United States who are theists and Christians in particular than in most other parts of the world. That's not surprising. Mm. It reflects the general status of religion in the United States. But I don't know. I don't make predictions as to what will happen, but I would sincerely hope there is as little influence of sheer fashion as possible.
Yeah, great. So obviously just address and interact with the dialogue as much as possible, and obviously don't follow any fashion trends, basically.
Yes, that's right. I think that's the danger with philosophy is it becomes fashion-ridden. It's if you just look even at a fairly recent history of philosophy, I mean, you think that what was dominant in English-speaking philosophers and people who expressed themselves with clarity and precision and so on, I mean, these weren't mystery mongers, but was very hostile to metaphysics a mere 60 years ago. And that was, it's not that any individual being hostile to metaphysics is a bad thing. I mean, it's just the fashion that it was just considered so out of fashion that really good metaphysicians like Peter Simons had to put forward their views as logic. They had to pretend somehow they were doing logic, not metaphysics. That's the sort of fashion I don't like.
Trends and conformity and norms obviously penetrates any discourse, and obviously philosophy isn't any different in that respect.
Of course, I would have asked you what your views were, but
I would personally, I believe that the fact that there are laws of nature, they didn't have to be necessary, but they were possible, and because they were possible, that's why we have them. No more than it's possible that I could die of a heart attack in the next hour. Obviously, it's not probable because of my relative age, but it's still possible, and if it were to happen, it would be because it was a possibility. Now, as we've mentioned and as you've clarified earlier, there are additional problems when one thinks about actualities and possibilities. So whether these possibilities in themselves have to be necessary is another interesting fact that I haven't had much time to ponder on, which is very interesting. But in terms of why there is any form of existence, I believe that the laws of nature didn't have to be this way, but they are because it's possible, and then everything else has been set in motion from that, not necessarily in a deterministic way, just in a causal chain. So we came about by, obviously, the Big Bang, or anything that's prior to the Big Bang is still a big mystery, but once these laws of nature were set in motion from the beginning of the Big Bang to us, it's just one long process of a contingent causal chain to finding ourselves in a universe that we are, where we just happen to be particular animals with consciousness. Now, I personally believe that consciousness comes from material aspects, although the hard problem has got some interesting points behind it in terms of why there'd be any subjective aspects such as qualia in itself. Why is it that material property can throw up anything like a subjective experience? On the other hand, I appreciate that's actually quite mysterious, but just as mysterious would be the opposite argument that consciousness is somehow innate and can throw up materialism. So in both respects, they're both very puzzling and very mysterious, and just as a matter of choice, I go for the fact that consciousness comes from materialism. And in terms of the theistic explanation for the natural world that we live in, although reducing it down to a possibility of an agent making a choice is an interesting way to look at it in terms of possibilities, because it divorces itself from necessity and still presents possibilities. And one of these possibilities is that then an agent exists. But I think another problem here in terms of analytic philosophy and explanation would be that where do you stop? Does the explanation require an explanation in itself? So I think we've found some common ground in terms of why is it that the laws of nature in themselves exist? Are they possibilities or necessities? And that's a challenge that you would throw to, I'm assuming, to my view on naturalistic laws and explanation for the universe. And at the same time, I would feel that if it boils down to a choice of an agency, then I would want to know why this agency exists in itself, and then we're going to have to explain the explanation of the universe. So I appreciate there's problematic issues on both sides, but for me, from what I've seen in terms of logical argumentation and some evidence, I'm more inclined to go with just a naturalistic worldview, even though I would very much prefer there to be some kind of precluding fundamental agent that makes some kind of conscious choice, because if nothing else, that would be more interesting.
Do you believe these other possible worlds exist with other laws?
Yes, I do. I do. I do believe that's possible, and I believe that if they do exist, then they're just as objectively real in themselves as anything else. It's just that there isn't a conscious observer to be there, but that doesn't mean they don't actually exist. I mean, it's extending the same argument. You could say that surely the universe existed before there were conscious animals, but then that obviously gets down to the track that I believe that consciousness comes from materialism in an evolutionary process, is where you would say that consciousness precludes materialism. So for me, it's quite easy to see how the world would actually exist prior to consciousness. But for you, where it's a determining factor of existence is the actual existence of consciousness is what determines actuality, you would say that's obviously problematic. And that's one area where obviously we disagree on. What are your thoughts on that, Peter?
Oh, well, my thought is that I think you're following David Lewis quite a long way. And one of the arguments is this, that among all these possible worlds, ones inhabited by conscious beings like us, there are all these worlds that have been fine up to now. They've been governed in an orderly sort of way. But the laws of nature in these worlds are sort of mischievous. And just as of this present moment, all hell's going to break loose and everything's going to go chaotic. Now, the problem is this. We seem to know we don't live in that sort of world where everything's going to suddenly change. Or at least we're confident it's most unlikely. And yet, according to David Lewis, there are just as many worlds with counterparts to us, people very like us, up to this moment, except the next moment, as I said, all hell's going to break loose. That's one of the arguments people produce against David Lewis. And I'll just close, if I may, by inviting you to reflect upon it. Because if you find you're committed to worlds with varying laws, where do you stop the laws? Do you say they have to be sensible laws, or do you include among the possible laws these mischievous ones where it just goes berserk the next moment?